Flashback Twin Cities. I am Tom Osman. And with me again is James. Good morning, James.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm glad to see you survive the polar plunge.
Just barely. My heart almost blew up.
Now, did that feel like about 1,000 needles pressing against your existence when you jumped in that water?
Well, I don't know about the needles, but it definitely kind of just sucked my breath away.
There you go.
Those 3 seconds underwater felt like 15. And I was doing my best not to grab the ladies in front of me and just yank them back behind
me. Well, we don't want to be doing that now.
I try to pull out of the water.
And how many offers from the DNR have you received to do their spots now for the life jacket fall in the water commercials this summer?
Oh, you know, there's too many to count. Too many to count.
You know, we had Dennis Falcon on last week, and I think he was amazed by the fact not only was it cold here, but then we're going to actually partake in an event where we jump into the cold water for amusement. And I pulled out some information, and I'm looking at the Winter Carnival, which is going on right now. Did you go out and look for the medallion? Did you have the metal detector out?
No, you know, I've never done that. I'm a little sad.
I'd do it if it was warmer. That's the problem, is I'm not going to go in the cold and dark to do
well,
it.
Well, everyone would look for it if it was warm.
Well, that's just it. So in 1885, a New York newsman who we're saying he was indirectly responsible for the first Winter Carnival. He said St. Paul was another Siberia unfit for human habitation. Now, another East Coaster coming to the Midwest to tell us that we're not fit for our own existence.
Well, that's a little mean.
A little harsh.
A little harsh. So, I mean, he's not entirely wrong. I mean, this is...
Well, you know...
I don't understand how people survived here in the 1800s.
Well, apparently, what you do then is you don't just take that. You get even. You create what's called the Winter Carnival, and you don't shy away from your ice and snow. You celebrate it. So
I like that. Embrace it.
The record height of a building was originally thought to be 137 feet. This is the nice palace built in 1888. The challenge is there's no credible information that actually measured these palaces. They didn't keep the drawings, the plans of this 137. This is eyeballing it. The History Center does have photos, and they actually place it about 125 feet top with a 12-foot flagpole. This is back in 1888. Flash forward 98 years later to 1986. Lake Phelan, were you around?
1986, I was around.
You were around, but not
sure was not driving.
Okay, well, I wasn't driving either, but wasn't far from home. In 1986, the Winter Carnival, through a collection of volunteers, through tradespeople, and through the whole community of St. Paul and the Twin Cities, built what was then thought to be the tallest ice palace, ice castle ever, at 127 feet.
With that 12-foot flagpole on top?
You know, I'm not sure of the flagpole on that one, but you'll probably see there's tons of posters of this palace. Let's listen to some audio just to get a feeling of what this was back in 1986.
Hello, I'm Ruth Spencer, and it's hard to believe that less than a month ago, in February of 1986, a towering crystal palace made of nothing more than ice and snow stood right here. Today, there are a few reminders of the St. Paul Winter Carnival Ice Palace. Most of us have nothing more than some photographs and our memories. But now, KSTP Television has brought the Ice Palace back to life in a video scrapbook, and we welcome all of you with VCRs to record the show that we've put together. If you don't have a VCR, we hope that you'll simply sit back and enjoy watching a bit of history unfold.
So to kind of set up this video, which is on tcmedianow.com, the Ice Palace had been demolished because what happens in Minnesota, we think that we're out of the winter spell. It gets a little bit warmer, and you can't have a 127-foot Ice Palace melting and a toppling tower on you.
Apparently, someone thinks that's a danger.
Yeah, again, you know, you get people that are all concerned about safety. Let's listen some more.
Weighing 10 tons was lifted into place, and the tallest ice palace ever built was completed. It was dedicated to the memory of 7 astronauts who died just days before in the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger.
Whoa. revealing the palace. And let's go on. And to give you a little setup, when this palace was complete, there was a few setbacks. There was an insurance policy that the builders needed to maintain on this. It was a $1 million insurance policy that no one could find someone that was willing to put up the $50,000 to maintain the insurance policy. Go figure, people are up on towers putting up ice with electrical components in the water. They want an insurance policy. And luckily for the carnival, the president of Channel 11 did put up the $50,000 for the parade to be complete.
Wow.
And that was Joe Fransgar, that he put up the $50,000 for the insurance policy. The palace continued.
Did he get a lot of people coming to him to say, please put this up, or was he just going to do it on his own?
You know, I think, it was Channel 11's money. I think that there were some ratings to be had. I think there was some media coverage to be had. It might have been a business decision, but nonetheless it happened. And living from that side of the metro, this was an incredible thing. Now, St. Paul would get a lot of visibility to the capital, to the Crocus Hill area, to some of the great colleges. The east side, Lake Vale area, does not get a lot of visibility. So the Ice Palace was a great thing. Let's listen to a little bit more Ice Palace audio.
Soon, the inevitable had to happen. For safety reasons and because volunteers had to provide round-the-clock security, the palace had to be destroyed.
When we're talking about volunteers, people can only give so much, and everyone gave everything that they had, and you just have to stop asking after a while. There's other things that we have to do, whether it be earning a living or getting on to the next project.
The Victorious Vulcans, or as they're sometimes called, the Harbingers of Spring, took over the palace, and with their direction, on February the 20th, the demolition began.
The Vulcans helped destroy it.
I thought the Vulcans were the coolest things ever.
They get some mixed press occasionally, but they are part of St. Paul, and they are a lot of fun. So again, this is Flashback Twin Cities, and we're taking a flashback to the 1986 Winter Carnival. At the time, the hugest ice palace that had ever been completed. There was two more ice palaces subsequent in 1992 when the Super Bowl was here, and 2004, which I recall was about 25 below every day, and I went out there to see it. And
you're a brave man.
I think I walked in, much like you at the Polar Plunge, I walked in and walked out, I think, by the time, because we had waited in line to go see this palace in 2004, which was closer than we got at 86. At Lake Phelan, we, as Minnesotans, we drive. It's winter. You drive in your car to go see this ice palace. Picture the worst part of downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul traffic in rush hour, and that's what was going on around Lake Phelan, which was not, this is not five-lane traffic. This is two-lane traffic at best, with cars parked around. There is some video on tcmedianow.com, and again, if you want to watch this, we do have two documentaries on the Ice Palace on tcmedianow.com. The news crews couldn't even get down to the Ice Palace to do filming because they were stuck in traffic. There's actually a video of a news reporter on top of the van in stuck in traffic, just relaying information to the newsroom, saying that the report won't happen tonight because they can see the Ice Palace in the distance, but they're not going to be able to see it live on the scene.
It might just be me, but I think the best news is taken from the roof of a van. It seems like all the good stuff happens from there.
Action news. Just a couple more stats. I found this fascinating. This was done by mostly 40,000 hours of volunteer work. And had this been contracted to the trades, it would have cost $1.5 million to build the palace in 1986. In 2013 dollars, that's $3.1 million to build the Ice Palace, which we looked at, we loved, and then we tore down.
We're kind of odd up here.
This segment is only in Minnesota can we build structures of ice, jump in ice, and be proud of it. So to the New York newsman in 1885 who said we were a waste of existence, we showed him.
That'll learn him.
We come back. We'll be talking to a person who knows a lot about ice palaces, because I believe she was anchoring from the ice desk back in 1986. Kirsten Lindquist of KR11, KSDP, CNN, and many other junctures and projects will be with us next on Flashback Twin Cities. Flashback Twin Cities. I am Tom Osmond, and joining me live from California is former CARE and KSDP anchor Kirsten Lindquist. Kirsten, how are you today?
I'm just great. It's about 67 degrees out here, and the sun is shining, and it's a wonderful place. I'm happy to be here. Happy to be on the air with you.
You just had to say the temperature, because we're looking at about 18 degrees right now.
You're killing me.
And the winter...
Let me make you feel a little better. We had a stretch of I would say it's Twin Cities like weather here a couple weeks ago, where we got down to about 23, 24 at night.
Wow,
that's tough on Californians. Also on the vegetation, you know, and our houses aren't built the way the homes in the Midwest are built.
No, this is true, and that is I can empathize with their situation.
And it may be shallow, but yet, you know, that does make me feel a little better.
Well, see, we feel spreading that love around.
Okay.
And by the way, right now, appropriately, it is winter carnival time, and appropriately we brought you in today because not only did you cover the winter carnival, you sat at the famous ice desk.
I did indeed.
So when the program director or the news director said, hey, we're going to bring you out the Winter Carnival, okay, and then we're going to have you sit at an ice desk.
Mm-hmm.
What went through your mind? Are you from California originally, correct?
Well, yeah. Actually, I moved to Minnesota to anchor for what was then, what was it, before CARE.
Well, it was WTCN, then it was
WUSA. There you go. Sorry, I'm having a senior moment here. WTCN. I moved to Minnesota from Los Angeles, and the day before I flew out for my interview, I was sitting on the beach. When I arrived in Minneapolis, there was a blizzard underway, and I thought, oh, my.
You know,
what am I doing?
Everyone who tells about their first time in the Twin Cities that's not from here, we had Dennis Falcon on last week, and he was from Florida. And everyone tells the same story. Somehow, when we have a great talent come to town, that it snows, and it snows hard. And then you're off the airplane, and you're making this second guess of your career decision to come to a place that, as one New York writer put, a Siberia unfit for human habitation.
I will say this, though. My time in Minnesota was some of the best time in my life. I really loved living in the Midwest, and I missed the folks of the Midwest.
Well, that's great. In fact, that's why we're going to talk to you today, because this is Flashback Twin Cities, and Kirsten Lindquist is my guest. I want to talk a little bit about this Ice Palace desk, though, because we want to move...
I was trying to avoid that, but go ahead.
No, so tell me, you're sitting in the newsroom, and... the station manager says, okay, we got this great story for you. You're going to go out to the Ice Palace, but sit on an ice desk for the live newscast. What goes through your mind?
Well, you know, Tom, I'm a big believer in trying everything once, and I wasn't fazed. I thought it was kind of an interesting, exciting proposition. And even though at times it was a little uncomfortable, it was a pretty neat experience, really.
Was your chair made of ice?
No, the chair wasn't made of ice. But our legs were encased in an ice desk, and that was pretty chilly. We did all kinds of things to keep warm. We had those little hand warmers you put in your mittens. And I did have an incident with one of the news directors once that might be kind of fun to talk about right now.
Let's hear it.
Well, it was very cold. I don't remember how cold it was. And I was begging to wear a hat. And back in the day, it wasn't cool to wear a hat. It wasn't okay to wear a hat. And I got into a real tussle with the folks in the control room who said, you can't wear a hat, you can't wear a hat. And I kept saying, I want to wear a hat, I want to wear a hat. And it came down to, you will not wear a hat or else.
Wow.
So I went on the air without my hat. And lo and behold, we had calls that came in from viewers saying, why wasn't she wearing a hat?
Of course. Research shows Kirsten should wear a hat.
Yeah. Yeah. So not long after that, I guess, you had the option. It was really cold, though.
They said if Paul Douglas does not wear a hat, then you don't wear a hat, right? If he's out in the backyard.
I don't know. that was just one of those little TV stories that I remember and sometimes share with folks.
Well, tell us a little bit about your background in media. You were one of the first anchors at CNN, and before that did mm-hmm. radio. Tell me a little bit about your background before you came to Minnesota.
Oh, geez. You know, I'm one of those folks who kind of worked her way up from the bottom. I got into the business after I heard about a radio internship at a all-news station in Washington, D.C. I was going to a junior college in Northern Virginia, not liking it, had never been a great academic student, much more hands-on. I learned by doing. And so I wasn't enjoying that, although I was doing it. And I heard about this internship, and I went in and applied for it and wound up spending the summer working for a CBS O&O, which is owned and operated station, all news, WAVA. And at the end of the summer, when all the other college student interns went back to school, they hired me. And so my first job was to call the police early in the morning and find out where the traffic problems were. And then I would get on the radio and relay the information to a guy in a helicopter, Walt Starling, who was flying over the D.C. area. And he would take everything I gave him and report on accidents, even though he wasn't anywhere near them. And so that's really how I got my start in the business.
And you never thought about doing news or doing media prior to that, prior to hearing about this incredible internship?
Well, actually, I had. My grandfather was a pioneer in the broadcasting business. He was one of the first sportscasters in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he was actually, a couple of years ago, inducted posthumously, of course, into the, I think it's the Bay Area Sportscasters Hall of Fame or something like that. And I grew up in a family that was very tuned into the media, very tuned into sports, because, of course, that's what Grant broadcast. He did the first East-West Shrine Games, covered the San Francisco Giants when they were the Seals. And he just instilled in me this passion for communications. And initially I thought I might go into sports, but wound up living in Washington, D.C., because my family moved there when I was a teenager. And at the time, Watergate was happening and the Vietnam War was winding down, and there were all these things that were so exciting. And so anyway, I just wound up doing the internship, and it took off from there.
And then you ended up at CNN, which at the time was launching.
Well, I went from the radio station job to another radio station job up in Annapolis, Maryland, WYRE. And then I went to AP Radio when that broadcast arm of the Associated Press was launched in 1976, I think we went on the air. And I went over to AP working as, I mean, it's just anachronistic. I mean, we had these old cart machines, you know, and the reel-to-reel tape recorders, and I'd take in the soundbite feeds from our AP correspondents all around the world and record them and then put them on the carts and then feed them out to the member stations at AP Radio. And from there, I started writing news. I had some great mentors. I wound up, my first story was covering Linda Lovelace announcing her candidacy for president in front of the White House.
Which was a monumental presidential moment in this history.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was pretty wild.
Well, then there's a movie made of that, too, which, of course, we wouldn't know on this channel.
No, we
wouldn't watch.
No, this is a family
that's
radio
right, that's exactly.
program, right?
Especially this,
yeah. So anyway, you know, long story short, and it is a long story, I basically worked my way up through the AP and became the assignment editor there and general assignment correspondent, then was hired by another network, RKO Radio, to start a Washington bureau there, and then jumped from there to CNN. In 1980, we went on the air, and everybody who started at CNN, virtually everybody, was either a newspaper person or a radio person.
And let's look at this. CNN, the first all-cable news network. Well, first of all, cable. I mean, most places didn't have cable. And now the idea we're going to have news on as a TV visual 24 hours a day. This is a period where news wasn't even on three times a day. It was usually on at 6 and 10 at best in most markets. So now we're going to do news 24 hours a day. Did that at all, when you came down there, you thought, this is a little different. This is interesting.
Oh, it was exciting. You know, the job that I'd been doing at RKO, basically I was there for just a year. They hired two of us. The network was based in New York. And they hired a guy to cover the White House, and then they hired me to do everything else. And wound up setting up the bureau and then covering all the federal agencies. And we were basically reporting rock and roll radio news. That was what they wanted. And after, you know, having covered, you know, a broad base type news, everything at AP, I was not happy at RKO. Mm. So when CNN came along, number one, it was just so exciting, the thought of working for Ted Turner, number one, because his vision was revolutionary and, at the time, quite pure.
Well, and he had a lot of money, too, to invest in it, which was...
Well, you know, he didn't have a ton of money. And that's why we went on the air. We were non-union. We were sabotaged at times by the union shops. They hired most of us in March, or at the beginning of 1980. And we pretended to do TV while they were building the bureau in Washington and New York. We'd go out and cover news conferences. You know, those of us who'd never stood in front of a TV camera or read a teleprompter or any of that, we basically learned to do television in a couple of months. And the union shops, which were all the other networks, were not happy to see us. We were upstarts. We were, and we were, you know,
taking jobs
not
away.
Not union.
Right.
You're a
rapscallion.
Well,
yeah.
And this is your first TV. This is your first on-air TV experience at CNN. Your first time on the camera,
right.
And you got to anchor at CNN too, correct?
Well, I started out. They couldn't find an economics correspondent, and I've already established that I didn't graduate from college, right? So I had no academic credentials. But they didn't have an economics reporter, and you know, thankfully I'm pretty quick on my feet and I'm a quick study. So they made me the economics correspondent initially, and I went out to American University's college bookstore and picked up everything I could find on economics, and I tote those books around to all the hearings and sit in, you know, the Chrysler bailout hearings, for example, and then have to go live, you know, 10 minutes after they concluded. And thank heavens for those textbooks, because they really helped me understand what I was listening to in there.
It's amazing.
Anyway.
No, go ahead.
No, it was a fabulous, fabulous education. And, you know, 24-hour-a-day news was certainly a challenge and exhausting, but we were all really young. And it was, you know, what do I want to say here? We were breaking new ground.
Groundbreaking.
We were pioneers. And it was just so exciting.
No, Kirsten Lindquist, my guest today, talking about her time at CNN before the Twin Cities. So between CNN and between 1984, when you came to WTCN, where did you go?
I'm sorry, repeat the question?
I'm sorry, between your time at CNN and before you came to what was then known as WTCN, where did you go next?
Well, I was with CNN until I came out to Minnesota. I went to CNN in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Because my family, I'm a fourth generation Californian, and I was always torn between, you know, my passion for the news and for Washington D.C. Politics and international affairs, and my desire to be closer to my folks here on the West Coast. And so I wound up in Los Angeles for CNN at the bureau in L.A., which was right smack dab in the middle of Hollywood, and was reporting a lot of Hollywood news, and didn't like that a lot.
So you're on Venice Beach, and then you decide, I think that Minnesota's where I need to go next.
No, what I really wanted was a sense of community. One of the things that I missed at CNN, because when you're was the sense that you're part of a community,
right,
and that you're connecting with people in a community. When you're broadcasting to a national audience, you don't have that connection with the audience.
Right.
And my grandfather, again, who instilled in me this love of communications and broadcasting, was always plugged into, you know, local events and, you know, contributing his time. And I wanted something like that. So that's one of the main reasons I went to Minnesota.
Which, appropriately, is a very tight-knit community. And also, we don't take our media personalities for granted. They become part of us, and they become,
yeah,
like family. And I'm sure in your years here, you felt that.
I did. I really did. I really enjoyed living in Minnesota. I enjoyed the 5 years that I was on the air there. I also enjoyed the years after I left the business when I was living down on the Mississippi River in Lake City. I mean, it's a very special place, and the people are, you know, my friends in Minnesota are very genuine, and, you know, you don't instantly make friends in Minnesota, but when you do make them, they're friends for life.
They're lifelong friends.